Okay, is everyone ready? I want to start with a video here, okay? So, oh, it's over here. I just want you to watch this clip and we'll return to it later in the talk, okay? Okay, cool. We'll come back to the relevance of that in a little while. Right, now, I haven't got any sound, but it's not a problem. Okay, yeah, so what I want to talk to you about today is about our experience of seeing. Okay, so in a way, I'm not really going to talk that much about the visual system. I'm going to be talking about the output of that visual system. That is our understanding of the world around us. So I'm going to show you a little demonstration. If you've seen this demonstration already, then just bear with me and keep quiet so we can do it for those who haven't. So I'm going to show you a video in which there are two teams of basketball players. So can I first of all ask, before I start this, who's seen this demonstration before? Okay, so there's still a few people who haven't. So those of you who had, let's just bear with this. Okay, so what you're going to see when I start this movie is two basketball playing teams passing the ball to each other. The team in white only pass to other players in white. The team in black only pass to other players in black. Now, what I want you guys to do is to watch this very carefully and take two counts for me, okay? I want you to count the number of passes that the white team make to each other where there is a bounce between the two players. Okay, that's one thing I want you to count. And also the number of passes that, again, the white team make to each other where there's no bounce. So you've got these two things to keep track of. And they're going to be running around all over the place. So this is quite difficult. And just to make this more interesting, let's divide you into males and females and see who can do better at this task. Okay, so is everyone ready? Right, now let's have a go at this. So number of bounce passes, number of non-bounce passes. Okay, so how did everyone do with that task? It's quite a difficult task, right? Yeah, okay, so the interesting thing about that task is not how many bounces you were able to detect, but whether or not you spotted the gorilla. Okay, and it always amazes me that when you show this demonstration, there are people who don't see this guy in the gorilla suit. The first time I saw it, I didn't. Who else didn't see this gorilla? Yeah. Okay, quite a few people. Have a look around, right? You're not alone. Let's watch this video again. This time I'm going to point out what's going on.
Oh, I have a pointer.
Maybe. Yeah. Now, at this point here, not only that, but look. Okay. Seeing this kind of thing profoundly changed my career. I intended to start out working on flies, and then I saw things like this going on, and I thought that this was a little bit more interesting. So the question is, what is going on? And it's kind of weird, because we live in a society where we place this real emphasis on our visual sense. Okay, we have all kinds of phrases that, you know, about things like seeing is believing, or I saw it with my own eyes. And not only do we place these kind of emphasis on vision culturally, but we place it legally. So this is Nick this morning from some random legal dictionary, talking about eyewitness testimony. Okay, and it's saying much reliance must be placed on his testimony, for he has the means of making known the truth. Okay, now given what we've just done here, and the fact that none of us saw a gorilla walking across the middle of a screen, we can begin to get slightly worried about these kinds of emphases that we're placing on things. But what I want to do really is think about this experience of seeing and how that maps onto what the visual system is doing. And I don't know about you, but there's a lot of kind of this idea that the eyes work a little bit like a camera. Okay, people talk about that kind of thing all the time. In terms of our visual experience, my impression is that it works a little bit like a video camera. So as I look around the room, I feel like I'm able to smoothly pan my vision across this scene, and that at any one point where I'm looking, I have a whole range of detail of what's out there in the world. So when I'm looking at one point here, I can still see things out here. Do you all agree with that kind of movie-like experience of the world around us? Okay? Yeah. The question is this really what is going on? What can we say about how the eyes work that informs us about this? For a start, I also now want to return very quickly, before I go on to how the eyes work, to that video I showed you at the beginning, the guy answering the phone. This relates to the eyewitness testimony stuff. What can you remember about the guy in that clip? Can I say, hands up if you think he had glasses. Okay, did he have a beard? Hands up for a beard. Okay, how about the color of his shirt? Hands up if you think it was blue. How about brown? Yeah, it's not so easy, is it? Well, what's again slightly weird about that clip is what people... where is my pointer? Hello? There it is. Oh, God, this is like working in a mirror. What people don't always spot is the fact that there's two actors in this scene. So the guy who gets up there is not the same guy that answered the phone. And so, you know, this again, I think, is quite revealing about our visual sense, or at least our experience of seeing, and how it isn't quite what we think it is. Okay. So what can we say from the way that the eyes work? So we have this complete and continuous impression of the way that we see. But vision is neither of these things. So when we look at how the eyes work, the information that they send to the brain isn't complete. So we might think that we see everything around us in complete detail. So when we look out over a typical Dundee skyline, we might think that this is the kind of vista that we see. But in fact, we only have good quality vision in a very small area right in the center of where we're looking. And that area is about the size of your thumbnail held at arm's length. And beyond that, because of the structure of the cells in the back of the eye, in the retina, things become increasingly blurry. So in fact, what the eye is sending to the brain is something much more like this. And yet we don't realize. But because we only have this very small window of clear vision, what we have to do, if we want to know stuff about the world, if we want to manipulate something, if we want to read, if we want to do just about anything where we need visual detail, then we're going to have to move that window of clear vision around in order to see those bits out in the periphery. So we have to move our eyes. But there is a problem with moving our eyes, and that is that our eyes don't see very well when they move. Okay? So as soon as you start to move our eyes, it becomes difficult to see things. And we can demonstrate this now, so bear with me here. If you hold your hand out like this, this is something to do. Excellent. Now look at your thumbnail. Keep looking at your thumbnail, but start waving your hand backwards and forwards like this. Keep watching your thumbnail. And what you'll notice is that even, this is good view from here, what you'll notice is that even at quite slow movements of your thumb, everything beyond your thumb becomes very blurry, right? Now if you want to move your eyes slow enough that things aren't blurry while you're looking at the world, then you would have to move at this kind of rate. I can't even do it very well. About one thumbnail in every second. Now, if we think about the usefulness of that, I mean, that's not going to get us very far in life, is it, if we have to move our eyes at that kind of speed? So let's imagine, you know, at some point in our evolutionary history, we've got someone who moves their eyes in that way. They catch a glimpse of something orange and moving rapidly out of the corner of their eyes. Now, from looking there to see what that is going to take about a minute and a half, by which time that tiger has probably eaten you. Okay? So it's not a good strategy. The eyes have to move in a different way, but how do they move? So to do this, what I want you to do is turn to the person next to you. If you're not sitting next to someone, find someone. So pair up. Right. Excellent. If you don't know each other, this is a good time to say hello. Okay, so what I want you to do is the person on this side of the theater, look past your partner at the opposite wall and try and move your eyes as smoothly as possible around that end wall. And the other one, I want you to look deeply into your partner's eyes and see what, in fact, they're doing with them. Okay, so who can tell me how the eyes actually seem to move? Jerks. Yeah, I heard jerks. Exactly that. So we have this impression, and however hard you try to move your eyes smoothly across that scene, they're moving in this series of jerks. And we make, on average, about three of these jerks in every second, okay? So not only that, but we're actually blind while we're making these jerks. So these jerks are very short, and we don't see anything during them. And I haven't got a demonstration you can do for this now, but at some point, next time you're at home looking at yourself in the mirror, what you can do is you can look at one of, you can use both of your eyes to look at one of your eyes in your reflection, okay? And then look to the other eye in your reflection. And what you'll notice is you can always see yourself looking at one of your eyes, but you can never actually see your eyes moving, okay, because we're actually blind while that's happening. So what does this mean for seeing? What we're supplying, what's happening is during these jerks we don't see, in between the jerks is where we take in useful information. But in between those jerks, we're actually keeping the eyes stationary in space. So we're finding a point to fixate, we're staying there for about a third of a second, and then we're flicking onto a new location and staying there for a third of a second, and so on. So what the eyes are supplying to the brain is completely different from our movie-like experience. What the eyes are supplying is something like a series of static snapshots of the world at about 3 frames per second, most of which is blurry. And somehow the brain is turning that into this movie in the mind and our smooth perception. And the question is, you know, how on earth does the brain do this? And until fairly recently, if you read a psychology textbook that was written more than about 5 or 10 years ago, you will hear that they kind of thought they had a fairly good idea of what was going on here. And I want to talk you through this old idea that we don't believe anymore. And this idea was that if you're basically pointing the eye at a series of locations in the world, you could treat the eye as a bit like a camera and say that you take a snapshot of that location, you store it somewhere in the brain, and then when you look at a new location, you can add together, you can kind of store the old and the new, add them together and build up a picture of the world. So let me show you my very low budget demonstration of this. This is kind of representing what might be on the eye. So here someone's looking at the spout of this kettle. The idea is that you take a copy of that picture from the eye and you store it somewhere in the brain in an exact copy. Oh, you can't really see that. Okay, it's very bright. Bear with me. Now, a third of a second later, the eye moves on to be looking at something else. In this case, it's looking at some kind of plug in the wall. The idea then is that you take this new copy from the eye, you line it up with the bits that overlap from the old copy, stick them together, and already you've got a bit more information about the world out there. And so on, as we look just a few little looks around this room, you can see that the model that you're building up in the brain, in theory, is already giving you a reasonable amount of information about the world that's out there. And then the idea is that your smooth and complete impression of the world doesn't come from what's coming from the eyes, it comes from this model that you've built inside your brain. And it's a very nice idea and it explains everything. But the question is, does it work? So we can test this now. And we can test this using a very simple experiment adapted from Spot the Difference cartoons, right? But instead of seeing the two pictures next to each other, you're going to see them one after another in a video. So what we're going to see is a picture of a scene just for a brief time on the screen, a static scene. Then it'll disappear and be replaced by a grey square. And then the same picture will come back, but one thing in that picture will be different. In this case, it's the height of the bar between this couple having dinner. And then it'll go blank, and then you'll go back to the beginning. So you're going to watch a flickering sequence of pictures. Okay, and what I want you to do is just to see if you can spot the difference between these. I'm going to show you some examples. Now, if the old theories of vision are right, that we're storing a faithful copy of everything that we look at in the brain, then this should be fairly trivial, because we should store a copy of this first picture. Then when we see the second picture, we should still have that first picture stored in the brain. So spotting the difference should be relatively straightforward. Okay, so in theory, if the old textbooks are right, then as soon as the second picture appears, you should all be putting your hands up to say that you've spotted the difference. So let's see if that works. Okay, not a good start for the textbooks. This is hard, right? Okay, you were first off the mark. What do you see? No. Yeah, look, it's the engine. Okay, now. Interesting point about this, right? This is an important part of the image, okay? Planes have engines. It's right in the center of where you're looking. And now that we've drawn your attention to it, it's impossible to think why you didn't see that before, right? It becomes blindingly obvious that it's doing this now. I'm going to show you some more examples in a moment. When people first did these experiments, they couldn't understand what was going on, because they actually designed this. This experiment was first run at the beginning of the 90s, and they designed these just to give someone something easy to do while they were in an fMRI scanner. Okay, and the idea was that this would just be something that everyone could do, but no one could do it. And they spent about 3 or 4 years trying to work out what they were doing wrong, why people couldn't see these things, what were they doing wrong in their programming when they were making these pictures, before they realized they were onto something actually quite interesting. So let's go through some more examples. Again, put your hand up when you see the difference. Ooh, very quick off the mark. Interesting. Okay, you were very quick off the mark. What do you see? Yep, this guy's trousers are changed from blue to brown. Okay. Let's try another one. Interesting. Interesting that some of the same hands go up quickly. Well, go on, do you want to tell us what you see? Yeah, there's a tree appearing and disappearing here. One more example. Now, I'll be kind of irritated if people get this really quickly, because I found this one extremely hard, and it's irritated me for a long time. Thank you. Oh. Good. Okay. Do you want to... Someone back there was very quick getting it. So, yeah. Yeah, this window changing from white to light to dark. So... these are big changes, and perceptually, they're big things. You know, we're very sensitive to kind of, bright and dark differences, and yet these things are very difficult to spot what's going on. Now, this they interpreted as telling us that the idea of making a model in the brain might not be right, because, you know, we said at the beginning, if you were storing information about everything that you see, then this should be a fairly trivial task. But one of the problems with this is that we're looking here at static photos flickering. And does that tell you anything about the information what's happening to information when you move your eyes? Because we're just making some really weird artificial interruption here. So we can repeat the experiment again, where instead of having this weird interruption, we can make you make an eye movement and the change happen during the eye movement. So what I'm going to do is show you a scene in one location on the screen, and then the whole scene is going to jump to a new location. So you're going to be forced to make an eye movement. And during that eye movement, something will change. Okay, so I want you to see if this is easier. Okay. Again, put your hand up when you see the difference. So this isn't easier, right? If anything, I think this is a bit harder. Okay, do you want to tell us what you see? Oops, oh, bugger. Sorry? Yeah, folders on the table. So here we go. There's a set of folders here that when it moves to this location have gone. Okay? So these things also tell us something about what happens to information when we move our eyes. But again, we're in a slightly odd situation here of looking at static scenes that are either jumping. You know, the world doesn't do this. The world doesn't suddenly change from one position to another. Okay? And the world doesn't flicker in that way. So is this actually telling us anything about how we use our vision in the real world? Or is it something peculiar to these kinds of weird experiments that we're doing? So some people have been trying to think about more realistic ways of testing this. Okay? And particularly, you know, the people who made their careers out of writing papers on how we build our internal mental models were very critical of this early work, suggesting that, you know, static flashing pictures really don't tell us anything about vision in the real world. So a much more valid way maybe of testing this is to use something like a movie. And a movie is dynamic like the world is. It's not a flickering picture. So what I'm going to do is show you a movie. We've already seen one, but I'm going to show you another one now where I want you to look for the changes. And so every time there's an editorial cut in this coming movie, there will be a change to something in the scene. So I want you to try and spot what these are. Where did it go? Oh, it's over here. Okay. So, every time there's a change in the viewing angle, then there's gonna be at least something changing. I just want you to see what you can spot here.
I took the subway from Middleton and it took only about half an hour.
Really? I drove from Gresham and it took 45 minutes.
Hooray for public transportation.
We can vaguely hear this, can't we?
Call me here for this mysterious meeting.
Ooh, where's that sound coming from?
I'm planning a surprise party for Jerome and I need your help to keep him away from the house.
That's great, I'll do anything you need.
Good.
I hate surprise parties, but only when...
Sorry, the dialogue is really crap, isn't it?
Otherwise, they're great.
Very good.
Right, okay. How many changes did you see there? Let's... One? Any advance... Two? Any advance on two? There were 10. Okay, let's see it again. I'm going to try and count... Okay, now, I've watched this video more times than I like to think. I'm going to try and spot them as we go. If you see any, call them out, okay?
Hi, Sabina.
So, things to keep an eye on before we do... Hang on. Things to keep an eye on, right? Her scarf, the plates, where the cups are, where the cutlery is on these napkins.
Since I've seen you.
Yeah, it's great to see you, Andrea.
So how did you get here?
Oh, I took the
subway
from Middleton, and it took only about half an hour.
I don't think anything else changed.
Really? I drove from
Her scarf's back.
It took 45 minutes.
Hooray for a couple
Now, the spoon's over there.
So why did you call
me? Now the plates are white, not pink.
I'm planning a surprise party.
Now they're pink again, that's four.
And I need your help to keep him away from the house.
That's great, I'll do anything.
Now the food swaps sides, the spoon swaps sides, and I think the cups swap side as well. So that's seven.
Great.
Very good.
Bugger. Okay. there were 10. So this is really hard, okay? And this kind of illustrates any continuity editing people here. I want this job, right? Clearly you can get away with a lot. And it's quite, you know, it's quite interesting. You can get away, and we saw at the beginning, that you can get away with changing the actor in a scene. And as long as they don't look too different, then people may not even spot this, which is deeply worrying in some ways. But yeah, you can get away with an awful lot and people just don't see what's going on. But of course, you know, video sequences, sudden changes in the camera angle, again, they aren't very real. So what happens in a real situation where you're dealing with someone in a conversation? And that's a demonstration that I want to show you here. Right. Okay, so now this isn't really something for you to spot. You're seeing a bird's eye view of an experiment here. Let's just get rid of this. So what you're seeing here is, this is an experimenter who went out onto his university campus and just approached random members of the public, of this, which this is one, and asked them directions. Now, halfway through the conversation, two people carrying a door are going to walk between these two. Now, when that happens, this experimenter is going to swap with one of the people carrying the door. And what I want you to see, I want you to watch this guy for his reaction to the fact that he's suddenly talking to a different person. Okay, here we go. Here's the switch. Watch his reaction. None, right? They asked him afterwards, and he had no idea that he had the second half of the conversation with a different person. I don't know. Yeah, that's an interesting point. Ask me about that in a bit. Right, so about 50% of the people that they approached had no idea that the person they were talking to switched halfway through the conversation. Now, I find this fascinating but disturbing. Okay, it seems slightly worrying that you could be halfway through a conversation with someone and not notice the fact that you then carry it on with someone else, right? And they've done this in multiple different ways. They did another one with psychology students where they asked people to come along to sign up for a psychology experiment. And as they were coming along to fill in their details, the secretary that they were signing up with just said, oh, hang on a minute, I need to get a pen, and bent down, and someone else stood up and handed them the pen. None of the psychology students noticed that they'd just taken part in the experiment. Okay. So clearly, even in real situations, we're profoundly impaired in what we see. You know, we just don't notice a lot of what's going on around us. So let me come back to my little set of slides. Okay. So what does this mean? What can we say about this? Well, we can go back to this idea of keeping a picture in the brain and building up this model of the world around us and say, well, there seems to be a lot of evidence now that that just isn't happening, okay? We're not keeping some detailed record of the things that we've seen as we look around the world. And in fact, it seems that every time we move our eyes, or we blink, or we have some unexpected interruption to viewing, then we effectively wipe the slate clean in the brain. We just lose all that information of what we've seen and we start over, okay? And that I found, coming from a biology background, I found that concept quite odd. Because how do we get from, you know, if we're losing that information every time we something interrupts our seeing, how on earth do we get about the world in this kind of feeling of complete and continuous experience? And I don't know. and I don't think anyone knows at the moment. But one of the things is, of course, you know, we have eyes that can move. So why would we bother to build up this complete and detailed picture in the brain of the world around us? So if I want to know some detail about people who are sitting over on that corner of the room, then why would I bother to construct a model of it, then inspect that model and try and work out what was going on, when it's very easy for me just to look? And then I've got the information available because I've got this window of clear vision that I can easily and quickly point around the world. So there's no point in making a model, okay? And the thing is then, if we want to try and relate that to, if we want to test whether we have a complete and detailed picture of the world around us. So if I want to know whether I'm remembering what Chris is wearing accurately, the only way I can really test that is to look at him. And of course, as soon as I look at him, I can confirm that I did know exactly what he was wearing, okay? So it's a little bit like our perception of the world is a little bit like the fridge light. If you want to know if the fridge light is on when the door is closed, apart from getting inside the fridge, the only way you can do that is to open the door and then it's on. Okay, so as far as you are concerned, that fridge light is always on, in the same way that our visual experience, our complete visual experience, is always on, because as soon as we test it by looking at things, we have that information. So we just don't realize that there's so much of the world that we don't see. And yeah, I think exactly the same point that Chris was making about sound. What it seems to come down to a lot in terms of what we see is that we're drawing on our past experiences and expectations of similar situations. Okay, so we see what we expect to see. So if you show someone a picture of a kitchen and then ask them what was in that picture, people will generally remember there being kettles and teapots and things like that, whether or not they were actually present, because we have this very strong association between kettles and teapots. And so you can see that people kind of fabricate their visual experience based on what they're expecting to see. And of course, we can exploit this. And this is what magicians have been doing, and I guess filmmakers as well, have been doing for a very long time. We can start to, you know, when we understand just what people don't see, then we can start to use this information. And magicians are much smarter than psychologists and have known this for a lot longer than we have. So I want to show you, how am I doing for, am I okay? I'm not eating into lunch or anything. Okay, right, I want to show you a little clip of a magic trick. Yes, here we go. Okay, this has a soundtrack, which hopefully you can hear. If you can't, we'll just stop. Let's have a go. This speaks for itself.
Hi, I'm Richard, this is Sarah, and we're going to perform the amazing color-changing card trick with this blue-backed deck of cards. Now, the idea is very simple. I'm just going to spread the cards in front of Sarah and ask her to push any card towards the camera.
Right, okay, let's see. I'm going to go for this card here.
Okay. Now, Sarah could have selected any card at all from the deck, but she selected the card which is now face down on the table. And what I'm going to ask her to do is show us which card she selected.
Right, so the card that I chose was, in fact, the Three of Diamonds.
The Three of Diamonds, okay, excellent choice. That card goes back into the deck. Now I'm just going to spread the cards face up on the table. Give a little click of the fingers, and you'll see that Sarah's card here has now got a blue back. Not particularly surprising. What's slightly more surprising is all of the other cards have got red backs. And that is the amazing color-changing card trick.
Okay, so at the moment, that's not very exciting, okay? That was all done in one continuous cut, in one continuous shoot. There was no cutting of that at all and no editing afterwards. So that in itself, maybe not that exciting. But let's now watch the trick again, okay? this again, it's, you know, a bit like the videos at the beginning. It's not about the cards at all. There are other things going on in this video. So the things to watch when you see this again are these things being indicated here. The colour of top he's wearing, the colour of top she's wearing, this tablecloth and the background. Okay. Right? So now you're going to see the same trick again, filmed at exactly the same time, but from a different angle, so that you see what's going on.
Hi, I'm Richard, this is Sarah, and we're going to perform the amazing colour-changing card trick with this blue-backed deck of cards. Now, the idea is very simple. I'm just going to spread the cards in front of Sarah and ask her to push any card towards the camera.
Right, okay, let's see. I'm going to go for this card here.
Okay. Now, Sarah could have selected any card at all from the deck, but she selected the card which is now face down on the table. What I'm going to ask her to do is show us which card she selected.
Right, so the card that I chose was, in fact, the Three of Diamonds.
The Three of Diamonds, okay, excellent choice.
Subtle, right?
That card goes back into the deck. Now I'm just going to spread the cards face up on the table. Give a little click of the fingers, and you'll see that Sarah's card here has now got a blue back. Not particularly surprising. What's slightly more surprising is all of the other cards have got red backs. And that is the amazing colour-changing card trick.
So, out of interest, did anyone spot all those things the first time around on the trick? No. Okay. This might seem like a bit of a stupid example because, you know, surely we don't get fooled by such obvious things going on. I heard a magician told me once about a trick that was performed in which basically the magician went into the middle of the stage and held up a curtain, held it up for a few seconds, dropped it, and magically appeared was a donkey right in the middle of the stage. Okay? You know, the crowd were amazed that he could do this just simply by lifting up a curtain and dropping it. What in fact he did was he held up a curtain, then he got his scantily clad assistant to walk out and do some little performances along the front of the audience. While she was doing that, he put the curtain down, walked off stage, got a donkey, dragged it into the middle of the stage, raised the curtain again, and then dropped it. And, you know, this worked equally well for men and women, by the way. You know, the fact that you've got something else that you're focusing your interests on, you can get away with murder in the background and people just don't see what's going on, you know. And so I want to come back to these slides again now and tell you a little bit about some magic work. Oh, where's it gone? Right. I want to just walk you through some stuff, again, on magic that I've been doing recently. Now, not as exciting as appearing donkeys, but I have a collaborator who's a very good close magician. And again, the close magician often works on these same kinds of principles of distracting you from what would otherwise be a visually very obvious event. Okay. So what you're going to see here is we've been looking at how people watch magicians. So we've put a device on people's heads that monitors where they're looking, and then we can see what they're looking at points throughout this trick. So here we're going to see the magician performing a trick. We're seeing it from the point of view of the observer, and this little black dot that'll be jiggling around will show you where their eyes are pointing. Okay. What this magician is going to do, this will kind of be obvious for all of you because it doesn't work very well as a video. It only really works very well when you're in close contact to each other. But what this magician is going to do is make a cigarette and a lighter disappear. Okay, so you can see this black dot following around where the person is looking. Right. Now, I assume everyone got how that trick worked. Does anyone not see how that trick worked? Right, okay. Well, we'll see it again. It's a really simple trick in that all he does is drop everything. Okay? So the lighter is actually quite hard to see because he conceals it, but the cigarette, he just holds it about 10 or 15 centimeters above the tabletop and lets go of it. And that's all he does, okay? And you'd think that this would be really obvious. So let's watch it again and let's think about these critical points. So here he's dropping. There he just dropped the lighter. You can't really see that, so fair enough. Maybe that's understandable, people don't spot it. But now watch the cigarette. You see, it just dropped. Very simple trick. And again, when you're engaged, you know, just sitting the opposite side of a table with this person, you think you might spot the fact that he's dropping his cigarette, but people don't. Okay, we tested lots of people, and very, very few people could see what was going on here. But what you'll notice from this is that when... Okay. Do I want to say that now? Yes. Okay. One thing you'll notice in this particular example is that while this cigarette was being dropped, the person wasn't looking there, they were looking over here. Okay? So somehow the magician has misdirected people to look in the wrong place. And we've sort of looked at this across a whole number of participants and found, generally, here's people who didn't know they were going to see a magic trick. We fooled them into thinking they were going to be doing something else. But just at the beginning of the experiment, the experimenter asked if they would mind if he had a cigarette. This was before the smoking ban. And to make it plausible, we ran this in a pub. So we wanted a situation where it might be plausible the experimenter was going to smoke through it. So what we saw was that people who didn't know they were about to see the trick pretty much were all looking at this hand, the distracting hand, as a cigarette dropped. Okay, so these little markers show you where people were looking. Ignore the bit on the right for now, actually. If we told people exactly what was going to happen in the way that I did, you know, he's going to make a cigarette and a lighter disappear, try and work out what he's doing, they still were distracted by this hand here and weren't looking at the cigarette as it dropped. Okay, even when they were asked to watch that cigarette. If we then, what you see on the right here is the trick being performed a second time. And what's interesting is how they look. The places that they look at are very similar, apart from some people here who go down and look at the hand. Most people are still looking at the distracting hand. Yet the difference between these two trials is that on this one, no one spotted what was going on. And on this one, everyone spotted what was going on. So it's not just about making people look in the wrong place. It's about what people are attending to as well. So what was happening here is that the magician was still misdirecting everyone's eyes, but what they weren't doing is misdirecting their attention. So whether people were looking here or not, they were still attending to stuff going on elsewhere. So this is a nice trick where we can fool our eyes, but not fool attention once we know what's going on. There's another trick that seems to do the opposite, and I don't have a little video of this trick, unfortunately, but it's a very simple trick again. The same magician, all he does is throw a ball into the air a number of times. And on one of the throws, the ball disappears and doesn't come back. But the way that he does this, of course, is just he doesn't throw the ball the last time. He just pretends to throw it and keeps it in his hand. But what people always report is that they see this red ball go up into the air and then vanish. Okay? And the question again is, what's happening with the eyes in that situation? And here we've got a real throw. You've got the little red dot is where the ball is, and the white dots indicate where people were looking. And on this final one, it's a fake throw. The magician still looks up into the air. Now, what's interesting is, although people say that they watched the ball go up into the air, when you look at where they're looking, none of them looked up to where the ball was disappearing. They all look at his face, basically. So here what you're seeing is that the magician's fooling the attention here in that they think that they're tracking the ball going up and disappearing. But they're not fooling the eyes. So the eyes this time aren't being misdirected by the magician. It's just the attention. So it's another example of how we can tease apart where we look and what we attend to. But what's interesting, I think, about magic is why this works. What works is not just the fact that something else is going on at the distracting location. What's a very powerful cue that magicians use is social cues of where they themselves are looking. Now, you know, we are extremely prone to being influenced about where someone else is looking. So if I stand and stare at someone individual, firstly, it becomes quite uncomfortable, right? Secondly, if I was staring at you and then I look past you, there becomes a strong compulsion to also know what's behind you. And similarly, you know, if you're in a conversation and you look away at something, you know, people will tend to follow you. And this is what the magician is really drawing on when he's very good at misdirection. So this trick was repeated in which the magician, so you'll notice in this that the magician is looking up as if he's following the ball, and people generally, dutifully, think that that means that the ball is up there. Similarly, in the first trick, the cigarette trick, let's go back to that very quickly, what you'll notice is that at the crucial points, the magician is very deliberately and obviously looking in the wrong place. So he's looking very deliberately at his hand here as he drops the cigarette over here. And that seems to be crucial in making this misdirection successful. And if you repeat the tricks without that gaze cue, it just doesn't work, okay? So if the magician throws the ball, stays looking at his hand here, so it becomes obvious that the ball hasn't left the hand, the trick just doesn't work. People are not fooled by this at all. They all say, well, he just didn't let go of the ball. It's obvious, okay? So clearly, where another individual is looking has a strong influence on what you see what you sample in the world, and I guess, also your visual experience of the world. And that's where I want to leave it and say thank you.